Good morning. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, October 20th, 2020. As always, we'll begin with today's headlines. The first headline reads, "The Place to Be," and actually, it's a very large photo, front page center of the A section, and it's several people socially distanced with masks on, inside a public building. There are X's on the floor where people need to stand, and they're standing in a long line. That's the photo. And the caption underneath the photo reads, "In-person voting options expanded from 1 to 12 Monday in Champaign County, including the Tolono Public Library," which is above, this is the picture, "which drew a crowd. The 11 new sites, including locations in Champaign-Urbana, Mahomet, Rantoul, and St. Joseph, will be open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, and 1 o'clock to 5 p.m. Sunday through November 2nd. So that's how you can do your early in-person voting. And that photo is provided to the News Gazette by Robin Schultz. The next headline reads, "U of I School of Music honoring Nick Rudd," that's N-I-C-K, last name Rudd, R-U-D-D, "Music to Play On in Man's Memory." This article is written by Anthony Zillis and is based out of Champaign. Before Jason Finkelman moved to Champaign-Urbana in 2000 to take a job with the University of Illinois School of Music, he was a regular performer and attendee at the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn, a venue known for its eclectic music. In Champaign-Urbana, where he's Artistic Director of Global Arts Performance Initiatives at Kranner Center, Finkelman struggled to find similar music. Then he heard Nick Rudd play with Brian Reedy in the band Water Between Continents. "Water Between Continents had that aesthetic that I was looking for," Finkelman said. "I was excited about that." Rudd, who died in May, was a well-known figure in the CU music scene since the 1980s, when he fronted rock band Turning Curious and a host of others. But when Finkelman met him, he didn't simply meet a rock guitarist. He found a man who was fascinated with music across the spectrum. "He's just a natural empath," said Gina Manola, his wife of 13 years. "He was just so open to music and to many things, and to see people come together in that way through vibrations, really, that's what music is. He appreciated it very much." After her husband's death, Manola decided to seed the money for the Nick Rudd Music Fund at the U of I School of Music, which will provide programming for the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music. Finkelman heads the center. Among other things, the fund will support the Nick Rudd Music Experience, which will feature improvised music, the jazz, avant-garde, progressive rock, and music traditions curated by Finkelman. The first iteration of the event will likely happen in the spring of 2021, followed by annual concerts on October 19th, Rudd's birthday. So that was yesterday. It'll feature a wide range of music. For example, Finkelman mentioned that it could include Mongolian tuva throat singers and improvisational jazz guitarists. "I would imagine there will be another layer of energy around an event that is presented in remembering this wonderful artist that so many of us got to participate in making music with and enjoying music with," Finkelman said. For Manola, there was no better way to honor her late husband than providing a space for people to enjoy the music he loved. "He would spend hours and hours composing and listening to music," she said. "That was just the air that he breathed. I don't know what else or how else to say it. When Nick was playing music or experiencing music, Nick was whole." And there's a photograph in the paper. Perrone provided Nick Rudd plays with the Jans Project, J-A-N-S Project, in 2013. So that is a picture of, there's a picture of Nick Rudd playing guitar, front and center with another guitarist in the background, rocking on stage. The next headline reads, Do you have a voice? Use it and speak up when you see wrong. I could watch only about 10 seconds of the heartbreaking George Floyd video upon its release. To date, I still have not been able to bring myself to watch beyond the initial 10 seconds of seeing one man's knee bearing down into another man's neck, which would eventually lead to his death. I cannot watch because I immediately felt sick to my stomach. You see, as a black woman in America, while I saw George Floyd in that video, I also saw every melanin-rich black man in America that I know. I saw my childhood friends who are now middle-aged men. I saw my former college friends. I saw my neighbor down the street with a wife and a house full of children. I saw the doctor who lives several blocks away and occasionally zooms by in his convertible. I saw my first love. I saw the once troubled teen who became an impactful youth leader. I saw imperfect yet God-fearing men. I saw everyone who has a past but learned from their youthful folly and became respectable men. God forbid, but I saw cousins, uncles, nephews, and those close to my heart in the face of George Floyd for those brief 10 seconds. He could have been any melanin-rich man that I know. I cannot watch as one man lacked basic human decency as he casually stripped another man of his dignity. Why is this acceptable? Skin color. Too much melanin. In America, it has become a common theme for some white police officers to lack decency when dealing with melanin-rich men, and more commonly, the melanin-rich face. Aiming to strip black men of their dignity in these encounters is done openly, boldly, and far too often. More than 10 years ago, while I was in graduate school, I wrote a research paper that was supposed to be entitled Driving While Black. I used a focus group and selected approximately 15 black men for my research. I had a set of pre-written questions. All were about their experiences with police and driving while black. As I asked this group of men, from all different walks of life, to share with me their encounters, I was not ready for what I heard. The discussion quickly evolved to their first encounters, multiple encounters, and unreasonable encounters with police. Interestingly, the men in the group seemed to find much-needed comfort in sharing their stories with me and with each other. As one of the men spoke up and laughed at me for asking about driving while black, he explained that he had been stopped by police at the age of 14 for simply walking while black. Much of the group laughed and agreed about how they too had been stopped for the first time as teenagers and several years before they had a driver's license. This young man told me of how, at 14, the police smashed his face into a fence before throwing him to the ground and roughly searching him. Their reason? He looked suspicious. They found nothing and laughed as they walked away. Another told of how police stopped him in his car, emptied out his trunk, tore out his back seats, and brought in dogs to sniff out his car for drugs. When they found nothing, they left him to put all of his scattered items back into his vehicle. The seats remained destroyed, and they told him to be a good boy and stay out of trouble. He was 20 at the time. Two of the participants in the group were together in a situation in which the police stopped them, made them get out of the car, lie on the ground, and the police held guns to their heads while verbally insulting them. They both described how they did not think they would make it out of that situation alive. They were 18 and 19 at the time. I asked the men in the group if their families knew about these encounters. About 80% of the group said they had never told their family. One of the young men in the group was my own relative. He expressed that if he had not been a part of the focus group, he would have never told me about his encounter. When I asked them why they did not tell their families about their encounters, their answers varied. I heard, "I didn't want to worry them. What good would it do? And this is just what it means to be a black man." My heart broke. However, I could not help but notice that as they shared their stories with each other, a type of healing took place with each nod, each chuckle, and each description of unjustifiable aggression as they realized that they were not alone. The following semester, I took a different class in which the subject of driving while black came up after watching a brief video on the topic. I was one of two blacks in my class. The other was a melanin-rich male. The mostly white class found the video of black people describing their encounters of driving while black to be difficult to process. Most of my white classmates were in their early to mid-20s and had never had a single encounter with the police. The few who did shared very different stories from the black men in my focus group. One young man explained how, as a teenager, he and some of his friends were driving around recklessly at 2 a.m. in a pickup truck with open alcohol. The entire group was drinking. When the police pulled them over, they simply made them open and pour out every single can of beer and told them to go straight home and sleep it off. I shared with the class a few of the experiences from my research. Many found it difficult to believe that such things were happening. How can we each help? We must use what we have in order to restore decency, to restore dignity, and to destroy blatant double standards. Do you have a voice? Use it and speak up when you see wrong. Do you have privilege based on your skin color? Use it to challenge injustice. Use it to question why the 13-year-old melanin-rich boy is being targeted. Do you have 18-plus years of age? Use it to vote for those who believe in basic human decency. Use it to vote at the local, state, and federal levels for leaders and lawmakers who believe that all people, including those who are melanin-rich, deserve to be treated with dignity. So this is an article from this continuing series that the News Gazette is putting on. It's continuing a conversation we've hosted since June. The News Gazette asked African-American community members to share their stories and solutions in the wake of George Floyd's killing. Featured today, Karenna Laplace, a Champaign author, speaker, business trainer, and financial and purpose coach. Champaign's Karenna Laplace is an award-winning author, speaker, business trainer, and financial and purpose coach. That's right. The next headline reads, University of Illinois, calendar change KOs spring break. No doubt this change will affect many of us in ways that are not ideal. This article is written by Ben Sigderman and is based out of Urbana. The University of Illinois Academic Senate approved canceling spring break and pushing back the start of the semester by a week. At its meeting Monday, the Senate voted 129-13 to approve the new calendar, which also includes 3 days off throughout the spring break, or spring semester, excuse me. The start of spring semester was pushed back from January 19th to January 25th. Spring break was originally scheduled from March 13th to March 21st. Excuse me, to March 21st. The 3 days off will be Wednesday, February 17th, Wednesday, March 24th, and Tuesday, April 13th. The semester will end at its usual time with commencement on May 15th. The fall data suggests that periods of extended non-instruction creates special vulnerabilities due to increases in travel, Chair Linda Morehouse said. We know that travel is a risk to members of our community, U of I epidemiologist Rebecca Smith said. Morehouse said the late start provides time in January for a staged return to campus for COVID testing and isolation protocols. The 3 days off were added for students' wellness, but were placed in the middle of the week to discourage travel over long weekends, Morehouse said. We were also keenly aware of mental health concerns for our students, faculty, and staff, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, Kevin Pitts, said. The proposal attempts to balance the need to minimize and mitigate COVID spread while allowing for at least some breaks in instruction. Morehouse said the Provost's office will make limited exceptions for certain clinical and experiential courses that have special attendance requirements. As of October 13th, 8 of the Big Ten universities had canceled spring break, Morehouse said, adding that her committee unanimously recommended the new calendar only after much discussion. When this proposal was introduced to EPC, none of us were thrilled, Morehouse said. But she said the calendar changes were driven by the science and data that the university has collected through our SHIELD team and were made with much forethought, conversation, and collaboration. There is no doubt that this change will affect many of us in ways that are not ideal, but ultimately EPC was convinced it is in the best interest of the institution to support this proposal, Morehouse said. Chancellor Robert Jones said the university was planning to share the new calendar widely this morning. We recognize that the schedule isn't everyone's first choice, but I believe we are doing as much as possible to balance these competing interests, Pitts said. The next headline reads, Illinois impact. Arcola schools go all remote. Ford, Vermillion report fatalities. And U of I positivity rate at lowest point yet. A day after Monticello High shifted to all remote learning for 1 week, Arcola officials announced that the entire district would make the same switch, but for 2 weeks, starting today. The move came after the district learned Monday of 5 new cases. That's in Monticello. Two local women in their 70s, one from Vermillion County who'd been hospitalized, one from Ford County, lost their lives to COVID-19, health officials announced Monday. The Vermillion fatality was its fourth in 2 weeks. After 4 straight days of new cases in single digits, the 7-day positivity rate on the U of I campus is at its lowest point yet, 0.1%. 6 cases emerged from 4,320 tests Sunday, following a 2-case Saturday, and 9 cases on both Thursday and Friday. Champaign County's 7-day rate was up slightly to 0.6%, but active cases declined by 3 to 337. The zip codes with the most, 61820, Champaign, 72 cases, down by 7. Zip code 61866 out of Rantoul, 67 cases, that's up by 5. Zip code 61821 out of Champaign, 39 cases, that's the same as last week. 61822, Champaign, 38 cases, that's up by 4. Every region of the state has started to move in the wrong direction, Governor J.B. Pritzker said, as Illinois' 7-day rate increased for the 13th straight day to 5.4%, and new mitigation measures were put in place for Region 5. And we'll read more about that later on in the paper. And these stats were compiled for us by Jeff D'Alessio of the News Gazette. The next headline reads, Top of the Morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Our annual Faces of the Winter photo shoot took place outside the News Gazette on Sunday. 177 high schoolers visiting in masks and uniforms for an event hosted by Preps editor Colin Likas and photo editor Robin Schultz. As usual, the friendly kids played along on our many social media outlets, including a record day on Snapchat. Search for News Gazette on the app, and you'll see Unity's rockets take a stroll along Devonshire Drive. Here's hoping there's a winter IHSA season. Either way, we'll publish the photos in print and at newsgazette.com starting in November. Also, college football writer Scott Ritchie will be one of a handful of reporters in the press box at Wisconsin's Camp Randall Stadium on Friday. Illinois was issued 6 credentials due to pandemic restrictions. We'll go to press late that night for full coverage in Saturday's News Gazette, then go into even greater detail about what will be the strangest opener in school history in Sunday's edition. Brian Barnhart and Martin O'Donnell will have the radio call from Camp Randall, too. Questions, comments, suggestions, email Jim Rosso at jrossow@newsgazette.com. And there's a couple of photos of lots of high school students in masks, kind of spread out. Jim Rosso photos, the News Gazette Urbana above, so they're standing outside the News Gazette offices, and Unity below were among, another picture, were among 43 schools represented on Sunday. The next headline reads, History. Area History. In 1920, one of the most notable burglaries in recent years was committed in Champaign when the Haven Sisters store on West Church Street was plundered of more than $6,000 about $78,500 in today's dollars in ladies' furnishings. In 1970, states opposing the 1970 law giving the vote to 18-year-olds told the Supreme Court that the measure was a dangerous shortcut undermining the constitutional system. This is the place where governments make the first shortcuts that eventually lead to their downfall, Arizona Attorney General Harry Nelson told the court. In 2005, after meeting with a mediator for more than 5 hours, Champaign teachers announced they would strike October 31st if no progress was made over the next week. We made very minor progress, said Greg Novak, president of the Champaign Federation of Teachers. At this point, we have no formal tentative agreements. It was pretty clear early in the evening. It was not a night for settlement. International history. Today's highlight. On October 20th, 1973, in the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, Special Watergate Prosecutor Archibald Cox was dismissed, and Attorney General Elliot L. Richardson and Deputy Attorney General William B. Ruckelshaus resigned. On this date in 1803, the U.S. Senate ratified the Louisiana Purchase. In 1977, three members of the rock group Lynyrd Skynyrd, including lead singer Ronnie Van Zant, were killed along with three others in the crash of a chartered plane near Macomb, Mississippi. In 1987, 10 people were killed when an Air Force jet crashed into a Ramada Inn hotel near Indianapolis International Airport after the pilot, who was trying to make an emergency landing, ejected safely. The next headline reads, Coronavirus pandemic. If not now, when? Deadline looms, but relief deal may still be far off. This article is written by Andrew Taylor and is written, it's based out of Washington and is written by the Associated Press, or Andrew Taylor of the Associated Press. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reported some progress in advance of a Tuesday deadline for reaching a pre-election deal with President Donald Trump on a new coronavirus relief package. But the same core problems bedeviling the effort remain in place despite optimistic talk from the president and his team. Pelosi negotiated for nearly an hour Monday with Trump's top emissary, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and a top aide called it productive. Pelosi hopes that further work will offer clarity on whether we will be able to pass a bill before the election, said spokesman Drew Hamill. Finally, they have come to the table and we're going to try to get something done, Pelosi said on MSNBC Monday evening. Let's make a judgment. We may not like this. We may not like that. So we may not like this. We may not like that. But let's see on balance if we can go forward. But with time nearly up for Congress and the White House to deliver aid to Americans before the election, the question remains, if not now, when? It's a key consideration for Trump, who has talked up the prospect of another package as he asks voters for a second term, and for Democrats hopeful that their nominee Joe Biden is on the cusp of winning the White House in November. The dynamic has created a tricky position for Pelosi, whose tough approach to the talks amid durable GOP opposition to a potential deal of almost $2 trillion has left all sides staring at the very real potential of the negotiations failing. Pelosi is angling for the best deal she can get. Maybe that's now, maybe it's later. It's a risk she's willing to take. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, is pushing ahead with votes this week on GOP measures that stand little chance of advancing. Trump has upped his offer to $1.8 trillion or more and insisted Monday that the Republicans will come along if a deal is reached. But Republicans have spent months talking about a smaller aid package, and the top GOP vote counter, Senator John Thune, said Monday that it would be hard to find the necessary Republican support for passages of any agreement in that range. Without an agreement, at least in principle by Tuesday, Pelosi says it'll be too late to enact anything by Election Day. And if history is any guide, prospects for a deal in the lame duck session after the election could be dim. If Trump loses, Congress is likely to stagger through a non-productive session comparable to the abbreviated session after the decisive 2008 Obama-Biden victory, or the 2016 session that punted most of its leftovers to the Trump administration. That scenario would push virus aid into 2021. If we delay this until the Biden administration, we're talking about 3, 4, 5 months. The American people cannot wait. Representative Max Rose, a Democrat from New York, a freshman facing a difficult race in Trump-friendly Staten Island, said on CNN, "With each passing day, without action, the American people will be suffering more." Pelosi calls the $1.8 trillion administration offer inadequate, saying that while the overall Trump offer has gone up, the details on a virus testing plan, aid to state and local governments, and tax cuts for the working poor still aren't to her satisfaction. At the same time, the Trump's GOP allies in the Senate are backing a virus proposal that at $650 billion or so is only about one-third the size of the measure that Pelosi and Mnuchin are negotiating. But the Senate GOP bill has failed once before, and Trump himself says it's too puny. A debate slated for Wednesday on the Senate Republican plan promises to bring a hefty dose of posturing and political gamesmanship, but little more. It will follow a procedural tally Tuesday on a standalone renewal of bipartisan paycheck protection program business subsidies that could cause Democratic fracturing, but isn't likely to succeed. Pelosi has faced carping from some Democrats for playing hardball at the risk of going home empty-handed, but that criticism has been largely muted since McConnell keeps stiff-arming the negotiations. "The bigger issue is McConnell," said Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, who raised eyebrows earlier this month in publicly advising Pelosi to endorse Mnuchin's $1.8 trillion top line. "I mean, the president has said, oh, I can get McConnell on board. Well, why doesn't he call McConnell and get him on board?" he said on Sirius XM Urban View on Monday. The last coronavirus relief package, the $1.8 trillion bipartisan CARES Act, passed in March by an overwhelming margin as the economy went into lockdown amid fear and uncertainty about the virus. Since then, Trump and many of his GOP allies have focused on loosening social and economic restrictions as the key to recovery instead of more taxpayer-funded help. The moment is challenging for Pelosi as well. For months, she has been promising a COVID-19 relief package of more than $2 trillion stuffed with Obama-era stimulus ideas, even though the Senate and the White House are both in GOP hands and will be at least until January. She has sharply rebuffed anyone who suggests that Democrats should take a smaller deal now rather than risk going home empty-handed until next year. "If Congress doesn't act, the next administration is going to inherit a real mess," said Harvard economist Jason Furman, a former top Obama advisor. "Economic problems tend to feed on themselves." And there's a picture of Nancy Pelosi in the paper with the caption, "Speaker of the House Representative Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, set a Tuesday deadline for Congress and the White House to reach a deal on a new coronavirus relief package before Election Day." And she's standing with her mask in front of a photo of the Capitol. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. I will resume reading the News Gazette with part two shortly, so please stay with me. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.